our next item, number eight, agenda item eight, College of Forestry Dean's Research Initiative on the Marbled Murrelet Project. So.
Hello.
Hi.
Chair Iverson, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board. My name is Jennifer Weichel, and I'm the wildlife biologist from our private forest division. And I'm happy to welcome back to your meeting here Dr. Jim Rivers and Dr. Matt Betts from the Department of, College of Forestry to give you an update on the Marbled Murrelet Project. I'll turn it over to you guys.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Chair Imason, members of the board. Thanks for the opportunity to come back and discuss our project with you. It's hard to believe it's been 12 months since we last chatted, and we've been working on this and making some good progress. So I wanted to share that with you today. As Jennifer said, we've got a fair bit to get through. So the way that we're going to structure this presentation today is to first kind of get you back up to speed on some of the critical knowledge gaps for murrelets, talk about some of the work that we've been doing and how we're trying to fill some of those research areas. From there, I will give you an update on our demographic monitoring project. This is where we put most of our efforts into field work and trying to find nests and trying to understand what factors influence nest success. And then from there, I'll turn it over to Dr. Betts, and he's going to share with you some of the work that we've been doing focused on modeling and trying to understand murrelet occupancy dynamics relative to forest conditions and to changing ocean conditions. So as you know, the murrelet is really unique amongst North American seabirds, in fact, amongst North American birds, in that it requires two very distinct ecosystems to maintain its populations. Murrelets are like many other members of the auk family in that they get all of their food from the ocean. They're diving seabirds. But that's where the similarities end during the breeding season, because this species does not breed on the coast and does not breed in large colonies. Instead, it moves inland to nest into some of our older coastal forests. And it turns out, as you recall from last year, this represents a really big challenge for us to understand the breeding habitat needs of these birds. Murrelets are small. They're about the size of a robin. They are fast-flying birds. They've been clocked at nearly 100 miles an hour on radar, believe it or not. And they move inland under low-light conditions early in the morning and late in the day. So finding birds is pretty challenging. They also move over very large distances. So some of the nest records that we have throughout the murrelet's range in the lower 48 states have found nests dozens of miles inland. So unlike other seabirds, these birds are dispersing across the landscape. And what they're doing is they're looking for really big trees that have large horizontal limbs on which they can place their nests. And so because of this cryptic behavior and because they are so dispersed in the landscape, it's very challenging to study them. However, it's critical that we have nesting data that allows us to recover murrelet populations. So the most recent estimate from the Northwest Forest Plan synthesis indicates that there are more than 750,000 acres of habitat that is considered to be either moderate or high suitability. But prior to the start of our study, there were only 29 active nests that were found. And if you think back to your statistics course, that is just not enough to really have a broad inference about what's going on with it, such a large area. Not only that, but many of those nests were found upwards of two decades ago or more. And we know that there's a lot of change that's occurred on the landscape as well as on the ocean within those intervening decades. And so that's where our project comes into play. The Oregon Marbled Murrelet Project is a long-term, large-scale study, and it's designed to better understand the breeding habitat needs of these birds. So we have several components to the study, as we talked about last year. But the part that we spend most of our time is trying to get more data about where these birds are nesting, whether they're successful, and then what factors may be influential on their nest success. So it's an involved process to do this. This is one of the reasons why we don't have a lot of good information. The spring session, May into early June, is when we capture birds. We do that by going out onto the ocean. We leave out of Newport each night that we can, weather permitting. And this in the upper left photo is the research vessel that we use out of Oregon State. And we use that large vessel because we offload a small Zodiac, and that Zodiac goes out into the surf and captures murrelets while they're roosting on the water. And once our capture crew is able to obtain a bird, they bring it back to that research vessel. And as you can see in the upper right, if the bird is of sufficient size, we can put on a tracking tag. Now, those tracking tags last about 3 months, and they allow us to monitor individuals and know where they're going in the marine environment as well as the forest environment. So the lower two photos show the nuts and bolts of this operation during the summer. We have a large crew that goes out and looks for birds along an 85-mile stretch of coast from Pacific City down to Sea Lion Caves near Florence. They do that almost every day so we can keep track of these birds. And then once we get the sense that the birds are moving inland, we then make use of our fixed-wing aircraft to try and figure out where that nest is. And fortunately, the tracking tags we have allow us to find that bird. When they sit on the nest, they're stationary, and they do so for 24 hours at a time. So we can know that once we hear a signal inland and it's not moving, that that bird is almost certainly on a nest site. So if all goes well, we have an opportunity for each of these nests to actually get some video footage, and we can go ahead and play this video. This is an ideal setting, but this is the type of information that's really useful for us to understand the factors that influence nest success. So in this case, a parent has returned to the nest with a food item, and parents bring a single fish, and they provide it to the chick. And at that point, the work of the adult is over, and the bird moves back to the ocean to get another fish. And so parents feed anywhere from 1 to 4 days on average, or I'm sorry, 1 to 4 times per day on average, and they deliver these large prey items. And as you'll see in a moment, it's up to the chick to make sure that it can swallow this food. It does so whole, and the chick spends most of its time on the nest. At the end of this clip, you'll see it just kind of settles down onto the nest, trying to be as cryptic as possible. The murrelets have evolved a behavioral approach to nesting where they are trying to avoid predators at all costs. So you can see there's a fair bit of down on this bird that gives a kind of a camouflaged appearance to it. So this video gives us information about how often parents come. In this case, we know that the parents brought a sand lance, which is a high-protein meal for the bird. This isn't all nests. This is one of our best nests. But this helps us to understand what happens to some of these nests. Now, this was at 11 o'clock in the morning on the particular day that we had videotape. This next video comes from later that day, and this bird is very quietly sitting on the nest. We can play that video. Notice it's not moving. It's not making any noise. And from above comes a nest predator. And if you know your birds, you'd recognize that as a red-tailed hawk, that rufous tail with a black terminal tail band. This is one of the things that we want to document on this project. What are the factors that may influence whether nest is successful or not? And what was interesting about this observation is this is the first time we've had a red-tailed hawk documented as a nest predator for murrelets. So just an example of some of the things that we're learning. Now, I don't want to leave you on a low note with respect to our video. So we got one more video, and we can roll this as well. This is a different nest from also from 2018. You'll notice that this bird, this is about 6:30 in the morning, so we have our night vision camera on. The bird has a lot of activity. It's moving back and forth. And just watch this bird for a second and see what it does. And there it goes. So what's really interesting about murrelets in their fledging is that they decide when they're going to leave the nest. And prior, about 24 to 48 hours prior, they start plucking off of that down off their body. And underneath that down are flight feathers that allow them to fly. So this bird, as it just left the nest for the first time, it's never flown before. It hasn't gone out and tried this. It's just decides it's the time and it goes. So this is 6:30 on the 7th of September. The other thing about this that's really interesting is that murrelets don't tell their parents they're leaving. And this nest had a parent arrive with a fish the next day to feed the chick. And you can only imagine what the parent was thinking because it arrived and there was no chick there. So it didn't know if it was successful or not. And we have no evidence that these birds reunite with their parents once they get on the water. We think that they're independent completely. So that parent was a little flummoxed when it got there that morning. So I show these videos just to kind of emphasize some of the valuable data that we're getting out of the project. What I want to do now is turn our attention to what we've found over this last field season working on the demographic piece. And the first thing to report is that the number of nights that we were able to get out and capture birds was restricted to about 40% of our nights. This is typical over the last couple of years. We're working in open ocean conditions, and we have a pretty thin margin that we can get out safely. And as you can see from this photo, these are members of our capture crew, and we have to offload that Zodiac at night. So it's a rather dangerous operation. So we can only do it on a subset of nights. We also, this year we had a smaller proportion of individual birds that were captured that we could put on radio tags. We have constraints on the size of the birds. They have to be a minimum of about 6 ounces if we can put a tag on as per our recovery permit. So some birds were just undersized. Others were not in breeding condition, so we decided not to tag them early in the season. In the end, that led to 53 birds that we were able to tag. The good news is that we were able to track some of those birds to their nest this year, as we did in 2018. So the photo that you see here is from the last nest of the season. This was a nest that ultimately was successful and fledged a chick. And if you look very closely right here off of the bird's back, you can see this small thin line. That's actually the tracking tag on the bird. So that tracking tag is really critical for us to find that nest and hone in on it. We had, I think I mentioned, 4 nests were detected this year. We add that to the 8 nests that we found last year, and that gives us a total of 12, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but when you put it in context of how many nests we had prior to the start of our study, that works out to be over 40% of an increase. This map shows the distribution of nests across the landscape. Most of our nests are found inland from Waldport and from Yahats. All of these nests were found on the Sayusala National Forest, so we know that that's a spot that has a lot of good murrelet habitat. And you can see that we have nests from 2018 in circles here and 2019 in triangles. I mentioned that understanding the fate of these nests is an important part of what we do on the project, one of the things that we really want to know. So we can take the 12 nests that we've captured or we've detected over the last couple of years and break them out into nests that were successful and nests that failed. So of a total of those 12 nests, 5 of them were ones that were successful. We either had confirmation by video or through other means that individuals were able to fledge from the nest. That means that 7 of those 12 nests failed, and that works out to be about 41%, which is in line with previous studies. Of those 7 nests, they fail during 2 different time periods. One is the egg stage. That's when the parents are incubating that single egg and they're sharing the incubation duties back and forth. And I mentioned last year that it can be very challenging to find these nests from our perspective. We know the bird is out there. We can hear it, but actually locating it on that tree becomes a real challenge. So of the 5 nests that have failed, 4 of those nests, we had to infer predation because we had evidence the bird was coming and going, but we never got a video camera up on the tree. And then we had a 5th nest that we were monitoring, and the parents ultimately abandoned that attempt. We don't really know why, except to say that one parent didn't come in for its incubation shift, and so the other one stayed for 48 hours, and then that seemed to throw the nest off, and ultimately the parents left that nest. The other 2 nests failed at the chick stage. You just saw the red-tailed hawk predation event, and we had one parent starvation event that occurred at a nest. We don't know why that occurred. We just know that parents slowed down their rate of provisioning to that nest. It could have been that there was something wrong with the chick that the parents picked up on, and so they slowed down their how many fish they brought per day, or it could have been the other way around, that there was something with the parent that restricted their travels to the nest. I should point out that all of these nests that have failed, none of them have failed because adults had been killed on the nest. We found all of the adults for these nests back on the water, and they were alive. So these are just failures that are occurring at the nest. One of the nests that we found, we never were able to find where it was in the tree. So that leads us to having 11 nest site characteristics over the past couple of years. And as you saw from that map, we have birds that are moving inland from varying distances. Some are just a couple of miles inland. Some are more than 15 miles. So there's a variety of different distances that these birds are moving into nests. And we don't find any real clear pattern with that. We don't see that nests are closer to the coast are either more successful or less successful, or that predation is and nest failure is bunched in space. Those 11 nests come from 3 different trees. We had 9 nests in Douglas fir, 1 in big leaf maple, and 1 in western hemlock. And as we would have anticipated, these are big nests. On average, the diameter breast height is about 50 inches, so really large trees, but some of them go up all the way to more than 6 feet in diameter. And as you'd expect, those are also tall trees. oftentimes over 200 feet in height, and the nests that we're finding are about 130 feet off the ground. And in most cases, you can't see these nests. If you're lucky, you get to see the bird come and go in the morning, and that's how we kind of pinpoint the general location, but you have to be in an adjacent tree to see that nest. Something that we've noticed in 2019 as well as the previous 2 years is that a subset of our tag birds are moving out of our core study area. Again, this rectangle that you see here is about 85 miles north to south, and each one of the dots that you see, red, green, or blue, indicate a location of a bird at one point during the season. So we have all birds for all days on these maps, and what you'll notice is that some birds go north and some birds go south. It depends on the year. In the first year, we had a majority of our tag birds left that core study area, and we were able to detect those because we were taking many of our aerial telemetry flights out of that location to find them because we didn't have any birds breeding in 2017. And that has changed over time to the point where we only had about 17% of our birds leave this past year. But note that the number of flights that we've taken outside of that core area really varies across years. So we can't say that we have more birds or less because our search effort for those birds varies. What we can say is that even with low search effort, we still see birds that are moving out of our study areas. This work has been done by Dr. Sophie Garcia-Harris, and she's continuing it on. And one of the reasons why we've focused on this work and why Sophie's putting a lot of time into this is because we know that there are different survey zones to get at-sea population surveys for merlets. And what we've documented is that birds are moving between these different zones within a given year. And unfortunately, due to budget cuts, we don't currently survey all zones at the same time. And so one of the possibilities that comes out of this work is for the folks who are in charge of those surveys to try and push for getting more funding to go back to a model where we have all of those survey zones. And we can say something about ocean conditions. Right now we're limited because zones 1 and 2 are only conducted in even years, zones 2 and 4 in odd years, and zones 5 every 4 years. So I think it would be a great resource if we could have those data in all zones and all years. The last thing that I'll leave you with is that the timeline for the project is very much what it was last year. This is a long-term project, and so we are slowly chipping away at it. Our short-term goals are to conclude some of the spatial modeling work that we've undertaken. Our midterm goals are to continue the demographic work that I shared with you today, as well as starting to look at some aspects of ocean conditions on nesting. We know these are birds of two different worlds, and they have to have healthy oceans and healthy forests. So we're thinking more about that and how we can incorporate that into our work. And then ultimately, we want to be able to evaluate some of the forest management effects on nesting. And so that's what we're working towards now. So with that, I'll turn this over to Dr. Betts, so he can tell you about our current modeling work.
All right, so Jim gets to show you fancy videos, and I get to show you fancy equations. Definitely got the shorter end of the stick. So as Jim mentioned, this was one of our original objectives of the project, was to do an exploratory piece with existing data, knowing that it would take quite a while for the intensive nest monitoring data and nest finding data to come in. So you should take these results in that vein. These are really meant to provide some initial results that help inform the demographic studies, the data that are coming. So this is our long list of authors, but I particularly want to highlight Joe Northrup, who was our postdoc on the study and now is working in Ontario and Canada. And he's the one that performed most of these quite complex Bayesian analyses. And I'll talk about that in a second. So one of the overall objectives of this part of the study was to see if there were, well, we already know there are important effects of mature forest loss on marbled murrelets. Obviously, it's an old forest-associated species, as Jim showed, with a tight association with large trees. But less is known about the degree to which ocean conditions influences the occupancy of the species on land. And as all of you know, ocean conditions have been changing over time, but particularly in recent years, deteriorating. Why am I showing you pictures of newts in my second slide? Well, it's a really cool species for one, but there's a lot of background ecological theory that indicates that species that rely on two habitats for breeding and survival are more likely to be at some risk than species that rely on just one. And so newts are obviously breeding in aquatic areas, and they have to move through terrestrial areas during the rest of their life history to get to the next breeding site. How are you doing over there with the Yeah, okay, good. And so there's been some evidence that across amphibian species, species that are dependent on an aquatic and terrestrial stage are more likely to be having difficulty with landscape fragmentation than species that just require terrestrial or just stay in ponds. And this is partly due to the fact that they have to move across distances and therefore are subjected to more risks. And so, of course, marbled murrelet, as Jim described to you, has this interesting and strange life history behavior of nesting in old-growth forests that humans obviously use for a variety of things, and is has still been declining across the landscape in the northwestern U.S., and also, of course, require good ocean conditions so that they can forage for their preferred prey items. And as I mentioned, we've had a variety of ocean heat waves over the last numbers of years, so it could be that ocean conditions are implicated to some degree in the decline, potential decline of marbled murrelets across their range. So the problem is that the existing terrestrial data we have for marbled murrelet are really noisy. They were not actually designed to do long-term monitoring with. They were designed, as probably all of you know, to determine whether a murrelet is occupying a stand, and which would potentially preclude harvest of that stand. So prior to harvest, it's required that people go out and they survey each stand over a period of 2 years, a minimum of 9 surveys to detect a murrelet. In some cases, surveying continues on federal land after detection. Often it doesn't. It stops either with occupancy, which means the stand is not harvested, or with no occupancy, which means often the stand is harvested. So these are the sorts of data we're dealing with here. Quite noisy up and down trajectories and occupied stands of murrelets over time. But the nice thing is there are a lot of data, unlike our 12 nests, and they occur all the way back into the late 90s. So the two questions we tried to address then, what are the relative influences of old forest on the occupancy of marbled murrelets and also ocean conditions? And in particular, we are interested in whether ocean conditions might interact with old forests. So do we see what we call synergistic effects of ocean conditions and forest loss on marbled murrelet populations? And so just a brief potentially review on what I mean by a synergistic effect. If you can see, under a regular normal ocean year, maybe the likelihood of a marbled murrelet settling in forest goes up with the amount of mature forest in the landscape. In a bad ocean year, murrelets might decide not to nest at all, and so there's no effect of the amount of mature forest. No matter how much you have, you're not going to see a marbled murrelet nesting there. And in a good year, maybe there's a particularly strong effect of mature forest. Obviously, these aren't data. These are just initial hypotheses we had. And so what we did to test these hypotheses, we have these over 70,000 surveys of murrelets that have happened over time since 1999. And in the A figure on the left, you can see how they're distributed across Oregon. Really quite continuous coverage. In the background is the green. That's old structured forest. So of these 70,000 surveys, they're distributed across about 19,000 sites, which is, again, they're not optimally collected data, but the sample size is quite phenomenal. And again, at each of these sites, observers have gone out during the breeding season, a minimum of 9 times over 2 years. So in addition to those marbled murrelet occupancy data, we have remote sensing data. And in Oregon, we're lucky enough to have a previous model that actually can quantify old growth forest structure. And I shouldn't say old growth, I should say old forest structure. This is the degree to which you see these big branching patterns, large diameter trees, high biomass, and this sort of thing. And so we use this gradient nearest neighbor approach that I won't describe in detail, and we quantify the amount of this old growth site index 80, which again is just really mature forest. Over time since 99, there's actually still been a decline in this old forest structure across all of Oregon. Most of that's driven by natural disturbance, but still obviously some is driven by anthropogenic or harvesting disturbance. So if you could play this video. I'm showing this video for two reasons. One is to show you, if it works, the noisiness in our data. This is just it's a small area down by the Biscuit Fire in southwestern Oregon. And these dots you're seeing appearing are the these occupancy records of Marble Murrelet. And the pink you see coming, which seems to be time-lagged, are canopy replacing disturbances. Maybe you got the picture from a little bit, but we're seeing those. So you can see the pink, yeah. And so the landscape is quite dynamic, even post-Northwest Forest Plan. And also these occupancy detections are quite dynamic. But there's a problem. One is that, the main problem is that it's possible that murrelet could be in a stand and not detected, right? Humans are imperfect at necessarily detecting marbled murrelets. So to handle that, we've had to implement quite a complex statistical model that accounts for imperfect detection. And I won't describe that in detail now, but all you need to know is that we have statistically accounted for imperfect detection. And we quantified Old Forest at two scales, 2,000 meters around the detection and also at 100 meter radius scale. All right, next slide, please. So ocean conditions are actually much more tricky than quantifying habitat on land. Previously, I mean, NASA and a number of other agencies have tried to estimate basic ocean conditions using a combination of at-sea sensors, but also remote sensing approaches. But to date, and most of the marbled murrelet literature, those ocean conditions have been not particularly predictive of what murrelets are doing, whether they decide to breed or not, and where they're moving on the ocean. And so we struggle with that for quite a while, because obviously it's basically a seabird, and we don't have information about its primary food resource. But I won't go into the details, but after some thinking on the part of the team, we realized the only way we could really get at ocean conditions more directly was to try and quantify the food resource in the ocean. One thought we could actually use fisheries data, potentially salmon or tuna catch. But it turns out that's not as comprehensive as we'd like. But NOAA, it turns out, collects data that can predict salmon returns, king salmon returns. And so we capitalized on those NOAA data, and this is Jennifer and Lindsay, who are two of our key project research assistants, and they gleaned these data from NOAA. And you'll see how they worked out in terms of quantifying ocean conditions. So these NOAA data are, it's actually incredibly straightforward. There's just a single transect line that goes out from Newport. And you wouldn't expect this would be predictive necessarily of ocean conditions up and down the whole Oregon coast. But really, again, it's the only information we had on the fine scale habitat information and food information that murrelets might use. I don't want to belabor this point, but in the end, this single line that goes out from Newport collects a bunch of data that could be relevant to marbled murrelet. Some of them have to do with salmon catches themselves. Some of them have to do with food resources that relate to salmon. And some are just thermal conditions. For example, the El Nino index. And these can roughly be aligned in a gradient from cool condition associated features through warm and through not very much food, and the warm conditions through lots of food. And so I'm going to call this principal component one for reasons that are more statistical. But keep in mind that this principal component is basically a gradient from what we'd expect to be poor conditions for murrelet on ocean through good conditions. So another variable we included in our analysis was just distance to coast. You saw that Jim showed that actually nesting prevalence reaches a peak around 5 or 10 miles off the coast. And you'd expect anyway, wouldn't you, that this marbled murrelet would be some energetic cost to moving as much as 40 miles inland. So we included that in the model as well. And I'm going to actually skip over this bit. I've decided to give myself a statistical day off. But really all you need to know from this slide is that we're estimating occupancy. We're also estimating the likelihood that a site that had a murrelet doesn't in the following year. We're estimating the likelihood of the site that didn't have a murrelet does. It gets colonized. And then we're also accounting for this P parameter, which is the probability of detection. Okay, so here are some results. So this is the probability that a site goes from being occupied to not being occupied as a function of this principal component of ocean conditions, okay? And so more food to the right of the x-axis, vacancy is on the y-axis, and you can see that this ocean condition variable we've measured using this one transect is quite predictive of the likelihood that a murrelet leaves or not. If ocean conditions are good, we see subsequent occupancy in the following year. If ocean conditions are bad, the likelihood can be almost as high as a third they won't be there the following year. So quite a strong effect of ocean conditions. Not surprisingly, we see quite a strong effect of mature forest at the landscape level, this 2,000 meter radius I was describing. And the more mature forest there is at the landscape level, the lower the likelihood of murrelet vacating the site. And then distance to coast would also be in the direction you'd expect, with sites that are further from the coast more likely to going being locally vacant following an occupied detection. We found some evidence, although it wasn't as strong as the rest, that there are these synergistic effects. So this graph is just showing you on the x-axis, that's proportion of forest within a 2 kilometer radius, and the y-axis is predicted colonization. And you can see that in the worst ocean condition year, it's a really low PC1, mature forest gets particularly important. So having mature forest around in poor ocean conditions is more important than when ocean conditions are really good. And this is sort of the moment of truth, is the question of whether these ocean conditions can actually predict the occurrence of marbled murrelet over time. Okay, so the blue line you're seeing there is this principal component one as it rises and falls, with high being good ocean conditions and low being poor ocean conditions. And you can see that our modeled murrelet data over time match that surprisingly well. I have to say it was one of those rare sort of eureka moments in the group when we saw the match between ocean conditions and the predicted occurrence of murrelet over time. Now, one of the potentially relevant policy pieces to this is that what do we do in terms of surveying for murrelets if we have multiple bad ocean conditions in a row? The current protocol is that we survey twice. If they're not there, we can harvest a stand. What if we have ocean conditions that are poor for more than 2 years? Are we going out and cutting marbled murrelet habitat that actually would have been occupied otherwise? And, you know, I emphasize these are really preliminary results, and this sort of 3 years question mark part you see to the slide is really based on just an arbitrary line of what we'd consider to be poor versus good ocean conditions. But I raise this because it's an important point to consider potentially, especially if it turns out our models are predictive going forward in time as well. So does this mean that we need to change the survey protocol? It's obviously very important in terms of influencing harvesting decisions. I'd say it's too early to say yet. Correlation obviously doesn't equal causation. If you think back to the beginning of my presentation, the idea of these data was to inform our more intensive demographic survey. What we'd like to see would be our predictions of ocean conditions showing up in our actual bird demography data, so the likelihood that birds actually that we tag come inland to nest. And also, we can now make predictions. I didn't mention this, but this ocean conditions variable is actually ocean conditions in the year prior to breeding. So this is actually quite important because it means that the year prior to surveying, we can make predictions, quantitative predictions about whether it's likely that murrelets will be coming inland. And so this year, it turns out the PC1 is not so good. And so we predict that potentially we'll see fewer marbled murrelets nesting this year in our data. But this needs to be validated going forward, I would think, for at least a few more years. Also, the survey data are suboptimal. You know, it wasn't designed for scientific study. It was designed for harvesting and policy purposes. And so really, this is my pitch. You know, of course, because we've got millions of extra dollars lying around, to have long-term in the same place survey data would be so strong. And I'm still trying to figure out a way of funding this at OSU such that we can have auto-detection devices set up at sites across the coast range that are out there, you know, for 20 or 30 years. We're also doing some work with our statistical models to make sure that because of the noisiness in the data, there aren't actual biases in our findings. We've done this quite extensively already. We're quite sure there aren't. But given the importance of the findings, we're going to keep pursuing that. And the paper that is reporting on these findings is still under peer review. So we'll keep you up to date with that as we go forward. So overall conclusions then, detailed information about ocean conditions are predictive the satellite data that I was showing you are not useful, but for whatever reason, this single line going out from Newport seems to be incredibly predictive of mirror load occupancy. Not surprisingly, mature forest at broad scale seems to be important for predicting occupancy. And it might be particularly important in poor ocean years. So as we see deterioration of our ocean conditions, mature forest might get even more important. And it's possible that we might need to think about surveying more than 2 years if ocean conditions continue to decline. As I emphasize, that result's still preliminary and we need to see if our predictions hold. So with that, I'll stop and thanks for listening.
First of all, thanks. That was a great overview. And thank you, Jim, for not letting anybody fall out of 150-foot trees and getting these data. A couple of questions about the scale and then one about the ocean conditions. Matt, you modeled at the 2,000-meter radius scale and 100-meter radius scale. Did you find any associations at the smaller scale?
Yes, but much weaker.
Much weaker?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Jim, related to that, you described the size of the trees that the nests were in. What about the context around those trees? Was there a 100-meter radius forest patch around them? Was it 2,000-meter patch? What constitutes that?
So that's something that we're actively looking at right now, and I don't have the results in front of me, but that's part of the piece that we're going to do as we accumulate more nests. At this point, given some of the interest in the survey zones, we've put a lot of our efforts towards understanding space use in the marine environment, but we had that on our list to do in the short term.
Yeah. Okay. That's going to be really useful for us because we have to figure out what constitutes a resource.
Sure.
And then the last question is, Matt, these ocean conditions change over time, right? And so the food sources for the birds change spatially, right, up and down the coast from year to year. Do the birds move up and down the coast in response to those changes in food conditions? And then when they are in a part of the coast where there are adequate food conditions, do they nest in that proximity? Or are they fixed? Is there a site fidelity for that nest is such that they will not nest if the food resources are not aligned with the nesting sites?
The wisdom is that there's strong site fidelity. But the data to support that are not very high. We know from our broad scale movement data that Jim showed you that these birds in a poor ocean year will move way up and down the coast. And this is kind of unprecedented data really showing that these birds will move all the way to Puget Sound or San Francisco. But we think probably in those years they're just hanging out. It's a long-lived seabird, the slow life history strategy. And so in a poor ocean condition year or following a poor ocean condition year, they likely just hang out there and float. And there are important implications of that we don't need to get into now. For the at-sea survey data, right? So in a bad ocean condition year, you might actually be picking up way more birds on the ocean because they're just not going inland. So one of the things we'll be doing with these data next is to try and combine the at-sea ocean survey with a terrestrial occupancy surveys.
Yeah, that alignment between the ocean conditions and terrestrial nesting sites seems to be like it might be an interesting piece of information to have. Yeah. Thank you very much. That was great.
So, Brent, if I could follow up on that, one of the things that really surprised me is that there are not forage fish data available, and these are data that turns out to be really challenging to get because most of the work on forage fish is occurring in federal waters, so not within the area where murrelets are typically spending their time. So we hosted co-hosted a workshop this fall to try and get people talking about forage fish and to learn more about what sort of data are out there. This is really what kind of connected us to Jennifer Fisher and some of the other folks at NOAA. And we're currently in the process of putting together a review paper to try and point out that this is a real key research gap, not just for murrelets, but for a lot of species in the near shore zone. And the hope is that we can use that and go to funding groups and say, we have all these experts that work on seabirds and marine mammals and fish and ocean conditions, and they're all saying we need to fund this. And so that's the hope, is that we can start kind of moving that forward. I will, one other thing to add is that we did tag one bird, and this is a sample size of one, But we tagged one bird in 2017 that went up to Washington, and we found it up there. We recaptured it in 2019, and it went inland to nest in Oregon. So we can't say that that's what the population does, but we can say one bird can move out of the area and can come back and ultimately nest. So this kind of speaks to the site fidelity piece a little bit, but with a sample size of one.
Any other questions? Well, thank you. When do we get our next episode, roughly?
Well, March seems to work for us. It's a good time because we're starting to gear up for the next year, and we have a good sense of what's happened in the previous year. So if that works for you, it works for us.
I'll put in a request for more videos. Those are cool.
Yeah. We've got about 8,000 hours of video, so we can find some more exciting.
Yeah, but the tragic ending. Hard to take. We will take a break until 3 o'clock. Oh, we do. I'm sorry. We have public comments. Oh, yes. Sorry about that. We will suspend. We'll not break yet.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, I'm calling you up. I apologize for that.
That's okay. It might be us, since there are some folks that think we're at break, but that's okay.
It'll be quiet in just...
Am I okay to go? You want me to wait?
Okay.
They probably expected no testimony from after that. Chair Imason, State Forester Daugherty, and members of the board, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Fran Caffaratico, and I've testified before you before, but just as a reminder of who I am, I'm a certified wildlife biologist. I own my own wildlife consulting firm, and the focus of my work is to assist large and small landowners to manage intentionally for wildlife across Western Oregon. I've written wildlife management plans now for over 500,000 acres for my clients, and a lot of those are in the range of the Marv Merlet. And then additionally, my family owns and manages small woodlands that are within the range of the Merlet. So you can imagine I track this issue really closely. And I'm just here today to offer my perspective on the Oregon Marv Merlet project. And first, let me just say that I'm so pleased that this research is being done. That's not the first time that I've seen that video of the red-tailed hawk predation. I have to say, I can't believe they showed it again. Like, I hate seeing that footage. They know it upsets me, but it's true. I mean, it happens. We have to acknowledge that. And then also, I just want to acknowledge my deep respect for the researchers that are working on that project and how important I think that work is. So I'm glad that they're coming before you and giving you that information. So you heard a lot today about how many birds have been tagged and where they're moving to and the ocean conditions, and all of that work is really important. And you've also heard that in some years, few of the tagged birds came inland to nest, and theories about the ocean conditions. And I think this research raises important questions that need further investigation. And I just have 3 points really short for your consideration. And the first really just is how important this Marv Merlet project is. And it's important for you to receive updates on this work. So I was glad to hear you're scheduling another one for a year from now. So I'll look forward to that too. And then I'm sure you're aware, but just in case you aren't, the Pacific Seabird Group has a Marv Merlet revision team. And so they're working on revisions to the protocol right now. And they're made up of a team of Marv Merlet experts from various state, federal, and private organizations. And they've been meeting regularly over the last several years. And the revision team has recently conducted their own analysis to reassess detection probabilities, which includes data from good, bad, and in-between years for ocean conditions. And these studies were specifically designed to inform the questions regarding the survey protocol for detecting Marv Merlets. And I just think that their insight is hugely important to the same questions that you're facing today and that was brought up by the OSC researchers. So I just want to make that point. And then finally, that the at-sea counts that are conducted as part of the Northwest Forest Plan monitoring do remain as the best data that we have right now for estimating populations of Marv Merlet. This is a 20-year survey effort that's been crafted and refined by professional agency biologists who are seeking the best information for management decisions. So just in summary, I'm glad to see you bringing the experts from the OSU study. You also have experts from the Department of Forestry that are on the revision committee. And so I just would really urge you to bring in experts from the revision team to learn more about the rigorous process that they're following. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we'll take a break until 3:05.